Thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me here. It's a pleasure being here. And the subject of my talk, and a slight deviation of what Atacı was announcing, is towards quantum computation with trapped ions, especially with trapped calcium ions. So I'm not going to talk about the beautiful experiments Dave Weinert has been doing recently, but I certainly will mention some of these results. First of all, I would like to make you familiar with what ion traps can actually deliver for quantum computation or quantum information processing. For this, we need to understand a little bit about the ion motion in linear traps and something about non-classical states of motion and especially decoherence times. And then I would like to make you familiar with some of our experimental results about addressing individual ions, some sideband cooling of the common motion, heating and cooling of an ion string, the procedure which we want to use to do some entanglement with the trapped ions, and eventually, if time allows, to give you some early results on cavity QED with a single ion. So let's just look into this again. You have seen this several times. What do we need for a quantum computer? First of all, we certainly need systems with long-lived quantum states. We've heard about this yesterday several times. And of course, we need single quantum systems which can be initialized, measured, and manipulated. And in order to make a gate, we need the control of interaction between those quantum systems. And all this can be delivered with trapped ions. And this is a busy transparency. However, let me just give you the summary of it. We need a certain hardware, and we need certain operations to do that. First of all, we have to realize quantum bits. The quantum bits can be stored in internal states of the trapped ions. We know that we have long coherence times with those states from frequency standards research because the ions are very well isolated in free space. A quantum register can be built by rows of qubits, so we can provide this with linear ion traps, as I will show you in a minute, with so-called ion strings. And eventually, the quantum gate relies on the interaction between those qubits, and this is done, of course, by the Coulomb repulsion, which comes for free with the ions, and the operations on the individual quantum bits can be done because we are able to address individual ions in our experiment. This is not that easy in the experiment with David Weinert, however, they have some very clever tricks to address also. The operations we need for realizing quantum information processing with those ions is, of course, an input and output operation and the computational procedure. The input will be a state preparation, and for this we need optical cooling, which we do, of course, with laser pulses. The output will be a state measurement. In this case, it will be a very efficient state measurement, as you'll see, with 100% efficiency, so-called quantum jump technique, and the computation will involve the excitation of internal and external states, and of course, entanglement. Let me just give you a brief idea how we trap those ions. Suppose for a second an ion is supposed to be resting here at the origin of a coordinate system and wants to escape in the direction of r. And in the easiest way, we just apply a binding force proportional minus r. Of course, we do that with electric fields, which are generated by the potential gradients here. And from that, we can immediately infer that the potential is to be chosen as proportional to r squared. And solving for the Laplacian's equation, of course, immediately gives you that quadrupole potential. Judging from that different sign in front of these coordinate factors here, we know that we cannot do this with DC voltages, so we need to have either an AC voltage superimposed to a DC voltage, or we have to take care that we get radial confinement with an axial magnetic field using the Lorentz forces. That would be the Penning trap, which used the same potential. However, I'm not going to talk about this today. I'm just going to talk about the Powell trap, which makes use of that AC potential here. The equation of motion in the Powell trap is a so-called Matthew equation. It looks fairly simple, except for this ugly factor, which really makes life a little more difficult, which is explicitly time-dependent. But all what we need to know is that this leads to certain frequencies of the secular motion in an average potential, which is governed by these factors A and Q, which just contain the information about the voltages which you apply here for that potential. So this is all we need to know. These frequencies of the secular motion in three dimensions are x, y, and z, so we approximate everything by a harmonic potential. And however, we have to keep in mind that there's always a micromotion present which perturbs the signal somewhat, and experimentally that's a nuisance, but we have to take care of it. The pole trap itself is then generated by these hyperbolically shaped potentials. That's a ring electrode and two end cap electrodes. And usually for single line traps, single line trapping, we use dimensions here in the order of about 1 millimeter distance between the end caps, or also ring diameter. And for this, we apply a cooling beam or an exciting laser beam diagonally through that trap and perpendicular to the beam direction we observe the fluorescence light. For a quantum computer with trapped ions, of course, we want to use now a linear ion trap, and I'll come back to that linear ion trap a little later. But let me just first introduce you again to that proposal by Ignacy Sirak and Peter Zoller, proposed to use a linear ion trap for quantum computation. Suppose for a second you could store L ions in such a linear trap, and we want to use internal states, either narrow optical transitions or ground state Zeeman coherences or hyperfine transitions, to store that qubit information. And we would form a row of those qubits just with L ions and to have a quantum register. Then the idea was to use a state vector of the quantum computer in the following way. This is supposed to be all the internal information. That's the external information about the center of mass motion of those ions. And they, in that proposal, they proposed to use a string of ions for the two-qubit quantum gate in the following way. All of these ions are supposed to be initially in the ground state of the center of mass motion. And, of course, the initial quantum information is stored in all of these ions. Then, any ion which is chosen to be, for instance, the controlling ion of a two-qubit quantum gate, a C-naught gate, is addressed with a single with a laser pulse, and that laser pulse is used to map that information of the excited state of that ion into the motion. You just feed in one phonon into the entire bus. One phonon is just the quantum of the vibration here, as we call it. Well, that really means that after you put in that motion into that string of the ions, you can no longer distinguish where the phonon came from, because now the string really starts to vibrate. In other words, we have entanglement in the string. So whenever you go to any other ion which now serves as a target ion, the second ion of the two-qubit gate, and make a transition which is conditional upon the presence of that phonon in the bus or not, then you can actually return here and take the phonon out again, and you have fulfilled the C-naught cycle. The details, of course, can be found in this. I'll come back to that later on. The physical question, the problems which we have is, can we do this and make a state measurements afterwards with 100% efficiency? That's, as I'll show you, done with the quantum gem technique. Can we do this with having a decoherence small, it's a heating small in the system, and eventually can we realize really a quantum computation as a series of those gate operations with laser pulses? So let me just give you some information about these ion traps currently being used. All derived from the Paul mass filter, as you know here, which is used to focus an ion through this potential structure and make a mass analysis. You can store these ions by winding rings around by these rods used to approximate the potential of that Paul mass filter. So that's the trap which we're actually using in Innsbruck, which has been used in Los Alamos for some time. The trap which is currently being used in the Boulder experiments of Dave Vineland and his co-workers is a segmented ion trap. And in the inner part, you see the four rods again, which contain the ions, and the end caps are just segments of these rods. This trap is also being used in Mainz currently and Aarhus. And the Munich trap is just uses retracted electrodes, which are formed like this, and they have these segments which allow them to shuttle these ions back and forth. And that's another trap which is also in use in the Boulder group, which is elongated, so which also serves to store small strings of ions along the long axis of that ring. Let me just concentrate a bit more on the trap we are using here. This is the real-sized ion trap. This is a coin, as it's used in Austria. So the size of this is just it's about 2 millimeter gap between these rods, and the distance between the rings is about 1 centimeter, as indicated here. This, and that's the important information, leaves us with frequencies of about 700 kilohertz in the axial direction, and in the radial direction between 1.2 and 2 megahertz in this first setup, and I'll show you some results with that as well. The NOAA trap, which is currently being used in our laboratory, makes use of electrodes which look a little bit more like knife edges in this case, and which have a spacing of only 1 millimeter, that gives us a higher axial frequency with the same potential parameters which we had before, and higher radial frequencies because the spacing is smaller in this direction, and the spacing between the tips here is also smaller. So you notice here we just rearrange things from the originally used rings and use now tips. The reason is simply we just want to have a tighter confinement in the axial direction with the same amount of voltage we apply. And this is possible to store strings of ions, as is indicated here. I would call this a quantum byte. These are just 8 ions, but we can go with the current trap from 1 to 15, and of course we are currently using only 1 or 2 ions or 3 ions just to make simple things going. So let me make you familiar with the system we are using. The ion which we are using is the calcium ion, and it was chosen for the reason that all of these laser wavelengths can be provided by laser diodes, so it's potentially easy, because in the lab it's currently a big machine. Anyway, so we are using here the 397 nanometer radiation of the Laud dipole transition for cooling. This can be provided by a gallium nitride laser these days, and another diode laser at 866, because the branching ratio is about 15 to 1 in favor of the ground state. But nevertheless, we don't want to get it stuck in the D3 half state, which lives about 1 second. The qubit can be implemented on this narrow transition between the ground state S1 half and the D5 half state up here, because that lives also about 1 second, so we have about 1 second time to do everything here. But we don't want to wait until the ion comes back, so in order to manipulate everything, we need another laser at 854 to get the ion back to the ground state. These 4 lasers can be used in the system. They are easy to operate in principle. What is now necessary to make a gate operation? There are 3 required steps in the system. First of all, as I've indicated before, we need to know how to influence the motion. We just want to remap the internal information in the excited state to a phonon in the bus. That is, we have to understand the spectroscopy of the system, so we need to know exactly how we can resolve that secular motion in the spectrum of an ion, in the absorption spectrum, to influence it. Second point is there's a necessity to put everything in the ground state, because the Dirac-Solar gate relies on the fact that you start with 0 phonons in the ground state. So we have to add the so-called additional cooling stage, what we call sideband cooling. And third, we have to use addressing of individual ions, because we really want to store the information in individual ions and we want to retrieve it from them. So let me just show you how this works in principle. This is what I call spectroscopy with quantized fluorescence, the so-called quantum jump technique, which is now routinely used in many standard laboratories to do precision spectroscopy. Suppose for a second you had a dipole Laud transition, as I've just shown you in the calcium, which is shuttling the electron back and forth between the S and P state. If you have a single ion only, or a single atom only, then of course the electron shuttles it back and forth, and as soon as you're excited now to a long-living D state, of course the electron gets projected to that D state and it's no longer available to shuttle back and forth. It doesn't scatter light anymore. That really means light switches off as soon as that D state is occupied. So when we observe this, and this has been observed, this is a real experimental trace in barium ions, which is very similar to the calcium ion, just has a longer lifetime in the D state. You see that the light really switches off as soon as that D state gets occupied, and you can actually measure that, and then it comes back, and so forth. However, that gives us not a handle to measure whether the ion was in the S state or in the D state prior to applying this kind of this radiation here. So this is the measurement Lewis was talking about previously. And this is currently being used in most standard laboratories to derive very narrow lines by exciting that D state. So for instance, you just draw a histogram of the absorption events as you walk with that laser over that frequency. However, we are just using this for the state discrimination. And for instance, if you count your fluorescence light, so in this case for about 9 milliseconds, this is a measurement two years ago. Nowadays, we just have to count it for about 2-3 milliseconds. Then you can see as soon as the ion doesn't scatter any light, you know that the D state was occupied. That's what we call the excited state. Or if it scatters light in that 9 milliseconds, you see the ion was in the ground state prior to application of that radiation, and you can see that this S state was occupied. After all, that gives you a detection efficiency of the system just by drawing an electronic line here, an electronic discrimination, detection efficiency of close to 100%. With this, we can actually draw now the excitation spectrum of that single ion on the quadrupole transition. And of course, that excitation spectrum must reveal all the residual motion in the system. So we have the carrier, which is just the transition from S1/2 to D5/2. But there is a number of sidebands available because the ion is moving in that harmonic trap. So you have the red axial sideband, the corresponding blue sideband. There's the red radial sideband and so forth. But there's also mixtures, the axial sideband and the radial sideband. But you understand all these features. And just to give you an idea what the current spectral resolution is this is just the carrier of the resonance, which is resolved to about 270 Hz, which gives you a spectral resolution of roughly 7 × 10⁻¹³. This by itself is just a pure number. On the other hand, this sets a time scale, which is very important for the manipulation of these qubits. This is on the qubit transition. You don't want to spoil your information by using a bad laser, for instance. So you really have to use a good laser, which keeps the coherence going at least for some time scale. So this is a first measure of the coherence time available on the system. Our question was, is this coherence set simply by the laser, by the system itself, or do we have any other perturbations? For this, we made the following experiment. We did Ramsey spectroscopy in this quadrupole transition and observed patterns as indicated up here. For this, we just applied, say, 2 pi over 2 pulses in a distance of 100 microseconds, and we can just change this distance. And when you now take the center part of these Ramsey fringes and make a visibility measurement or just draw the contrast as a function of the delay time here, then indeed I see that this contrast decays. And we know from these measurements that the 1/E coherence time then is on the order of about 2 milliseconds. So the laser line width, which just goes into that kind of measurement, is only 75 Hz. And to make a long story short, we are limited in the previous measurement which I've shown you on the carrier, not by the laser line width, we are limited by the residual Zeeman shifts, because the calcium 40 is an even isotope and it doesn't have the delta M, MF equals zero transition, so it's first order dependent on the magnetic fields. And we are prey to all these stray fields of the power line fields we have there, 50 Hz fields. In the end, we could actually actively shield these things or passively shield this using mu metals. We don't do that at this point, as I'll show you that we are not limited at this point with these magnetic shifts. We are currently triggering the entire measurement cycle with the power line frequency so that we have the same phase every time. However, if we want to improve the coherence in the system, in the measurement, we can actually do that. It's not too difficult. So let me just go to the second point. We understand now spectra. Let's just go to laser cooling. Laser cooling, just to summarize these things, in a trapped ion is somewhat different from free atoms. Suppose you had a two-level system and sitting in a trap. Then, of course, you diagonalize everything here and you get a manifold of these two-level systems which are just spaced by the trap frequency in U down here. So we draw this now in such a manifold with the ground state and the number of phonons in the system. And now you see there's a number of settings for the lasers available to do excitations in the system. So for instance, if you just tune the laser to the carrier excitation, that is without changing the vibrational phonon numbers, then that's a straight line here. But of course you can also tune now your laser to an excited state with one phonon number less. And now we have to know that the system predominantly decays spontaneously on its own system, like a molecule, and then it goes down to the ground state all the way. This is called sideband cooling because we have an excitation on the sideband and it just climbs down the ladder until it's really in the ground state. On the other hand, of course, you could do some heating by just choosing that transition. However, this requires that you're able to spectroscopically resolve that excited state here, to single out all these states, or in other words, it requires that the trap frequency, which is just the difference between these states, is larger than the natural line widths of these states. This is what we call the strong confinement regime, and which allows you to do some sideband cooling and eventually leads to small quantum numbers in that harmonic oscillator. Usually, for a two-level atom like the calcium, however, the excited state width is on the order of about 20 megahertz. So sideband cooling is not that easy because you're always hitting many, many of these lines here at once. That's what we call the weak confinement regime, and therefore we have usually numbers which are larger than one. So the question is, can we implement this? But before I'm going to do this, let me just show you how we actually measure that we are down there so that we can actually do something about it. For this, I've drawn now the harmonic oscillator levels on top of each other with ground state and the excited state. And we suppose for a second that the ground state population is highest already, which is indicated with the thickness of these lines. If you now make the absorption measurements, of course we can make an absorption measurement from the ground state with zero phonons to the excited state with zero phonons because there's heavy population here. We can go to that higher order, to the next sideband here, and the other sidebands are somewhat suppressed because the ion is really already cold, it's already down there. Then, if you go below that resonance, you see there's no equivalent here. So there's no excitation possible to that suggested state here, because there's none. Then we have to sum up all these contributions. And in the end, what you get is an absorption spectrum which shows some asymmetric sidebands around the trap frequencies nu. So the upper sideband is usually larger than the lower sideband because you have a lot of more population down in the ground state. And from this, we can actually infer what the ground state population is. Now the question is, how can we do this in calcium? And the idea is now the following. The only transition which we have available in the calcium, which is narrower than the dipole transition, is the qubit transition itself. So the cooling cascade which we came up with is the following. You make an excitation from the ground state to the excited state, but with one phonon less on the narrow transition on the D5 half state. But this would live too long, so we shine in the other laser, which carries it up to the P3 half state, and it subsequently decays in its own system down to N. And that, of course, gives the whole cooling cascade. So we effectively create a two-level system. And in fact, if you go through these numbers in detail, you can actually tailor the rate, which is an effective gamma, by just adjusting the Rabi frequencies and the tuning of that laser in such a way that you reach the strong confinement limit for the system. And doing that, we end up with a result which is indicated here. So for instance, after Doppler cooling only, that is after applying usual cooling, we end with that symmetry. We end up with that asymmetry, which gives us a residual quantum number of 1.7. And then we apply sideband cooling, and you see there is no absorption left on the lower sideband. And from this, we infer that in this system with a single ion, we get 99.9% ground state population. Just to show you that we can also manipulate, of course, this and coherently do all the manipulations necessary for a gate operation, this is starting from that ground state and doing Rabi oscillations, for instance, in the system. And then these higher states are not occupied. We expect to just cycle always back and forth between these two states. But on the other hand, we can also transfer, say, one phonon of motion from here to there by just shining in a pi pulse and then transferring everything via the P state, as I've shown you before, back down to the ground state and do the same thing. And if you do that, you'll see these traces. Here, we've actually cooled in three dimensions, and you see the Rabi flopping going back and forth nicely, and this carries on for another millisecond or so. And if you transfer everything to the first axial Fock state, NZ equals to 1, then you see it goes a little faster, as advertised it should go faster by a square root of 2, because there's a aggregation operator involved. So that works nicely, and we can actually do these things. The next important question for us was, how well can we do the cooling, and how do we suffer from heating in the system? Because that would destroy our coherence in the system. Cooling takes place roughly on a millisecond, and we can wait a little longer, it gets a little better, but that's not really necessary. So we have a rate on the order of about, or a time constant of the order of about 0.2 milliseconds per phonon. Heating, and here we were quite lucky, turns up to be not a real big problem in our system. We were afraid of having large heating rates because some experiments in the Vineland group showed that heating might be a problem. Here we came up with the mode which we are going to use for the gate operation, that's in the axial direction, with the rate on the order of about 190 milliseconds per phonon. The radial rate is somewhat higher, and there's quite some discussion going on between our groups because we try to understand what's going on in detail, but I don't have to have the time to discuss it here. In any case, so that seems to be fairly safe at the moment. Third point, about the addressing. We know from these pictures, as I've shown you before, we can actually see these pictures here. So we have the resolution with the optics, and the idea was simply just to trace the entire beam path back by using, for instance, a dichroic beam splitter here, using the fiber output of that 729 nanometer laser, and just do an excitation to the D5 half state by going through here an electro-optic deflector, which is then used to steer the beam across these ions. And as you can see from these figures, here we steer the beam to the right, here to the center and to the left, and we can individually address these ions and do also coherent manipulations. The resolution in the early experiments was set to about 3.7 micrometers. With the more recent experiments, I should actually mention this was measured by measuring the light shift directly at the ions, so that we know immediately the size of the beam here. More recently, for the two ion experiments, we came up with an improved beam diameter of about 2.7 micron, and that's actually the distance which we are currently using for a gate operation, which we hopefully will have very soon. So you can actually see from that fit in the green curve here, the residual excitation of that beam, if it's steered to that ion here at the location of that first ion, is really it's very small. It's on the order of about 10 to minus 3 and less. But let's go now to the spectrum of two ions. So if you add now two ions, of course, things are getting more complicated, because with two ions, you have a more complicated motion. You have two normal modes. These ions can vibrate towards each other, or they can go back and forth. But we understand all of these peaks. It's like a completely complicated molecular spectrum, but we know all these peaks. You have to understand that. And of course, then you can influence the motion in the same way. Sideband cooling then works in the very same way. You just apply the radiation on each of the lower sidebands, and without doing too much, you readily achieve population decrease state of on the order of 95% and better. And in fact, you can actually go to the same results as before if you just do this carefully. Two-ion cooling and heating works in a very similar way. We have cooling times on the order of about 1 millisecond, and the heating times are somewhere between 100 milliseconds and 200 milliseconds. Again, there is work underway, because we do not completely understand what the cause for this and what the real dependence for this is. However, we don't think that at current we are limited by this. Now let's just go on and do Rabi oscillations with two ions. Rabi oscillations with two ions can be done, of course, just by addressing a single ion and do, for instance, Rabi oscillations on the carrier. And here we see a first hint of a problem. We have seen these Rabi oscillations with one ion, and that seems not to be a problem for times up to about 1 millisecond. Here, look at this, even after 550 microseconds, we seem to run out of steam. So what is the reason for this? And this is even worse if you go to the upper sideband. The upper sideband, you see even here, that's not even a full cycle to be seen. And so that looks as if there is decoherence. We don't think it is decoherence in this case. Let me just show you what the real problem is. If you want to speed up your quantum computation, you really want to make the transition as fast as possible. So you want to crank up the Rabi frequency on the upper sideband, for instance, or on the lower sideband, which is needed later on for the gate operation. However, just a sideband which involves the phonon exchange. And if you do that, then of course there's also the possibility of having off-resonant excitation on the carrier here. And that carrier couples directly to that ground state, whereas here a small parameter, the so-called Lamb-Dicke parameter, is involved. So that really is a little messy system. And if you do this deliberately, then you find a Rabi flop which looks like this. So that would be the excitation probability if you excite on the sideband as a function of the interaction time, but now with a very high Rabi frequency, as high as we can make it. And you see, there's a heavy off-resonant excitation of the ground state, of the carrier excitation, of the carrier transition, and we can calculate this. This agrees very well with the calculations. However, it's not what we really want in the system. And this, of course, calls for the AC Stark shifts and the off-resonant carrier excitation, and by all the modes which are present and not really cooled. These are so-called spectator modes. And the only solution we came up with, and this is a we are discussing these things in detail also with Dave Vineland and others who are working in the field, is that we have to cool all these spectator modes. That, of course, is tedious. If you want to cool all these spectator modes with sideband cooling, this really means if you increase the number of ions in the system, you have an increasing number of sidebands. You have to tune, because the sidebands are so sharp, to each individual sideband and cool them. So this is a really tricky procedure and takes a long time. For this, we came up with a more recent procedure where we use the so-called electromagnetically induced transparency. So this is a procedure which requires some tricks. I hope I can convey that to you, otherwise we'd have to shift it to the discussion. The idea essentially is as follows. Suppose you have a three-level system. Now you're using a laser which is sort of tracing this state. Then, if you have a spectroscopy laser, which is indicated in green, going over going across these states, then you see the absorption as follows. You see a very broad picture pertaining to that excited state here, but you see a Fano profile here, a real zero, what we call a dark resonance, and a very bright resonance, very narrow, right here, which corresponds to the coincidence with that, the tuning of that laser. So if you do that, and you draw this now in a different way, just the absorption of the cooling laser as a function of the photon detuning, you see the Fano profile, which is indicated here at this point. Now the idea is to suppress any excitations on the carrier. The carrier excitation leads to excited state N to N, but the N state and the excited state could decay both ways. It could decay to the lower state with N plus 1 or N minus 1, so it causes diffusion in the system. By suppressing it and putting the carrier transition right here, we avoid having that. But if you now come up with the idea to do the heating, to have the heating transitions at a point where the rate is very small and suppressed by the low edge of the Fano profile, then you have little heating in the system. And cooling could be enhanced by using that bright resonance by the appropriate tuning for this. The appropriate tuning means you have to make the trap frequency equal to the light shift in the system of that laser here, of that tracing laser. And if you choose the parameters right, and I don't have the time to go in all these details, then you actually come up with a relatively good cooling rate, no heating due to that carrier suppression, and the cooling rate extends a spectral region which is broader than what we had expected, what we would usually get from ordinary sideband excitation. And just to show you how we do this in the calcium, we make use of the tracing laser now as a circularly polarized laser here, which goes from one Zeeman component, MJ equals minus 1/2 to plus 1/2 in the excited state, and the pi component, that's the spectroscopy laser which we have here in the system. And to make a long story short, here I'll show you some results of the asymmetry between lower and up sidebands, which were obtained simultaneously. So we just had in the system one cooling cycle. We were able to simultaneously cool both lower sidebands, which are different by 1.6 megahertz. So a whole range of frequencies can be affected at once. And if you just draw this as the cooling limit as a function of the measured light shift in the system, you see it's around 1.6 megahertz, so that's the frequency, center frequency, and it's below one phonon in the system in an area more than 2 megahertz, a little more than 2 megahertz. So with the best radial cooling, we end up almost as good as sideband cooling with 80%, and the best axial cooling even better than that from the Doppler limit of 17 or 8. So this is sideband cooling essentially by using electromagnetically induced transparency. However, now we do this simultaneously in a single shot. And this is especially valuable if you, for instance, want to have a string with 10 ions. This is a calculation that we expect to observe from 10 ions. From 10 ions, you can imagine there's a huge number of modes available, so would never be able to tune the sideband cooling laser to all these individual sidebands without having heating in between. So here, if you would expect to cool all these modes down in a single shot at the frequency of 0.7 megahertz, for instance, as we used in the first ion trap. So let me just return now to the Cirac solar gate. It's just 2 minutes? Okay, give you three. I don't have much time to walk you all through these steps. Important for the Cirac solar gate, right, is now that we have a pi pulse to do on a lower sideband, because we just want to map the excited state to a phonon right here. Then we have to make a 2-pi rotation to an auxiliary state, and again we have to remap things. This works out in detail here. And we are currently studying these things numerically. I'm not going to walk you through all these details here. I just want to draw your attention to these things, to some of these things here. What we are calculating here, this is a calculation which are currently being carried out in my laboratory by a postdoc, Hartmut Hefner from Mainz University. What we are calculating here is right now what it would be the performance of a Schirach solar gate with the imperfections which we have right now. So for instance, if you have the 2% imperfection in the pi or 2 pi pulses, 10% error in the rubber frequency, which we don't have. This is a maximum. We have much less than that. And 5% error in the state preparation. And you know, we can go down to less than 1%. Even if we do that, we can actually see that, for instance, if you go through all the cycle, this is now the population of this state. This means 0 phonons and both ions in the ground state, 1 phonon, both ions in the ground state, and so forth. And from that, we see that the residual population, which is really left, is less than 1%. So we can calculate these things in detail, and from that we can calculate fidelities. Right now we are more worried about the overall phases which are left in the wave function, because these phase shifts really depend sensitively on these different errors and imperfections which we have here. I don't have the time here, so let me just summarize these things in different timescales. The timescales which we have right now is track frequencies on the order of about megahertz. We need pi pulses on the order of about several 10 microseconds to complete a gate operation. Then the coherence times, which sets in here at the time where the laser, where the measurement really affects the system, is on the order of about 10 milliseconds. Heating is not affecting us currently, so we don't do anything about it. And the spontaneous lifetime is about 1 second. So from this, we conclude that heating is not the dominant problem in the near future, and decoherence will certainly allow us, as soon as we have everything manageable in the system, 10 to 50 C0 equivalent operations at current with a fidelity of at least 0.5, and I think we can go beyond that. That doesn't sound much, but we are improving on this. Okay, I could go on here with cavity QED with a single ion, but I think in view of the time, I should leave this out. The chairman is already nodding his head, so let me just go through this. Let me summarize. Okay. I've shown you how we want to implement quantum information processing or quantum computation with ion strings, where these ions serve as qubits and the strings serve as quantum registers. We have two different experiments here, so we can explore a wide range of parameters. Important is that the current spectroscopic resolutions sets a certain limit for the coherence time. However, we can improve on this. Right now, it's certainly not necessary. Sideband cooling, I've shown you with so-called using coupled transitions and EIT cooling. We did also Raman cooling and we did sympathetic cooling. All these things work, and I think the cooling procedures have been heavily explored. We know how to do this now. The relevant timescale I've shown you are such that we have a coherence time on the order of about several milliseconds, and we can improve on this, and we can do some active shielding and also passive shielding if you want to get rid of the magnetic influences we have in the system. Heating times are currently larger than 100 milliseconds, are not affecting us yet. However, I think with some information we have also from the Boulder group, we can work on this, and there are some experimental procedures available. Addressing works, and with this, we will make bell measurements in order to prepare for the real gate measurements, because that's just half a gate operation we need. And then, of course, we will make a real Schirach solar gate, which I hope can be done very, very soon. And as soon as we have one, I think it's pretty easy to have at least somewhere between 10 and 50 C0 gates available with these ions. And I didn't talk about cavity QED, but that would be another way of interfacing photonic qubits to the ion qubits. Thanks very much for your attention.
Thank you. So, questions?
I should go on here. This is important.
The limitation to coherence time, equivalence time, would be more severe if you scale that to 2, 4, 6, 8.
I don't think so at this time. Because we can check everything right now with 1 and 2 ions. We do not see a difference between 1 and 2 ions. I don't see a reason why this should be larger than that. Of course, if you go to a string, say, of 100, I expect to have some difficulties, just a few experimental difficulties. But up to 10 ions, I don't see that this is going to change.
Any questions? the EIT cooling scheme, what is the fundamental limit on that? I mean, you haven't got as cold as you were able to do.
No, I didn't have the time to explain that in detail. If you walk through this is really somewhere between sideband cooling and Doppler cooling, of course. You can never be as good as doing pure sideband cooling because you're just singling out one transition, and that's real optical pumping down to the ground state. With the EIT cooling, what you're actually doing, you're tailoring your absorption profile in such a way that you do very little absorption on the heating transition, very much on the cooling transition, and none whatsoever on and nothing whatsoever on the transition on the carrier, which actually diffuses. But it's always less efficient than sideband cooling. So with this method as we have it right now, we would have expected from our experimental results that we get down to 10^-2 in the end. What we have observed is 10^-1, so there's a factor of 10 missing. However, we don't really care. As an experimental procedure, it's good enough for us if the remaining phonon number is less than 1 or less than 0.5. I think that's sufficient. And so we didn't really explore what the experimental shortcomings are. We know, for instance, that the quantization axis in our experiment is not as ideal as it should be in the real application of the EIT cooling. So you have some residual optical pumping and some technical difficulties here and there. But we never really explored that. The internal states, I think you can infer the T2 time from the Rabi floppings we have there. You've seen them. And so that. The emotional heating, it doesn't even show up at that point. The emotional heating is on the order of about 100 milliseconds. And we have seen a few. That's right, that's 10 minutes with laser coherence time. And I think we could work on this. We can talk about this in detail. I think there's some other points there. We have some residual optical pumping. You saw a slight modulation in the Rabi flopping systems. That's something that we don't know. We'd like to measure that. I don't expect that to be worse. So from what I can see from the Vineland's results and what we have right here, I expect that to be on the order of about the same as the laser. Fine, 10 milliseconds. Not yet. That's there are no experimental comparisons yet. We have done some theoretical calculations on this just to see what procedures are best. There's, for instance, a gate proposed by Jonathan Plenio and Knight, which relies on light shifts. And this seems to be more favorable for our case. There's another gate by Milmer and Sorensen, which makes use of the fact that, makes use of two photon transitions, and which actually works even if you have a finite temperature in the system to some extent. For our frequencies and for our parameters, that seems not to be so favorable. So in order to speed things up, I think that light shift gate is probably more interesting for us. We are currently investigating all these things numerically with our current parameters, and of course it's going to be a problem for the next year, a year and a half, as soon as we have one gate, just to compare these gates and to see and to really measure the individual fidelities. Of course, we choose one. We have chosen the Cirac solar gate as the gate because we started out with it and we know most of it and we have set the stage for everything. But we will of course evaluate all the others as well.
Let's thank all the speakers in this.